But after that, he strayed from the straight and narrow path and took 2 degrees at Columbia. Now, you see how broad-minded the Harvard Law School Forum is. After all, 80% of the students at the Harvard Law School didn't go to Harvard College. Mr. Murray B. Levin, Dr. Murray B. Levin, is assistant professor at Boston University. He is also a lecturer at the U.S. Naval War College at Newport. He makes a special study of voting and voters, particularly in Massachusetts. He has published a book entitled The Alienated Voter and has a forthcoming book on political strategy. As the final member of the panel, I am glad to introduce to you Dr. Murray B. Levin.
Mrs. Roosevelt, Dean Griswold, members of the panel. The answer to a question that Dean Griswold raised a few moments ago is that 21% of the people who voted for Treasurer Kennedy thought that he was the senator from Massachusetts. I happen to know this because I've spent the last year interviewing voters in Massachusetts, and approximately 1 out of every 5 voters who voted for Treasurer Kennedy gave reasons which indicate beyond a shadow of a doubt that they thought he was the now President of the United States. The topic this evening is unrest in the Democratic Party. With reference to Massachusetts, let me say this. This is going to be a very difficult discussion because there is no Democratic Party in Massachusetts. There are merely McCormick Democrats, Peabody Democrats, Ward Democrats, Murphy Democrats, but there is no Democratic Party. The Democratic Party in Massachusetts has been reduced to that of a feudal system in which we have a number of party chieftains, each chieftain having a following, very loyal to the chief. In fact, what we have here is the complete breakdown or complete absence of centrality in the Democratic Party. Consequently, the problem of unrest is really the problem of unrest among the various warring groups. Now, prior to the Democratic gubernatorial primary in September, we interviewed a random sample of 320 voters in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. We were interested in studying the Democratic gubernatorial primary. Consequently, we drew 1/2 of our sample from registered Democrats and 1/2 of our sample from so-called independents, that is to say, unaffiliated voters. In fact, very few of them are independents. I'd like to talk very briefly about some of the major findings of that study and then talk about the implications of the findings. With respect to the people that we interviewed who voted for Volpe, we asked them, among many other questions, why did you vote for Volpe? 27% of them said that Volpe was the lesser of two evils. 28% told us they voted for Volpe for personality reasons. Two reasons of personality were indicated more than any others. One was that Mr. Volpe was sincere, and the other was that Mr. Volpe is honest. With respect to those individuals in our sample who voted for Ward, 16% of them said that Mr. Ward was the lesser of two evils. 33% of them said they voted for Mr. Ward because Mr. Ward is a Democrat, or the respondent said, I am a Democrat. 21% of the persons who voted for Ward gave us also personality reasons. He is sincere, he is honest, but even more significant than these two categories is the following response. Mr. Ward has a large, attractive family. He's a good family man. Consequently, he will in fact probably be a good governor. Now, if we analyze the anti-Ward reasons given by the Volpe people, that is to say, we asked everyone, what do you like best and least about Mr. Volpe? What do you like best and least about Mr. Ward? With respect to those voting for Volpe, what did you like least about Mr. Ward? 34% of them said Mr. Ward is corrupt. 24% of them said Mr. Ward ran a dirty campaign. Now, with respect to the anti-Volpe reasons given by the Ward voters, the only significant category is the following. 25%, Mr. Volpe is corrupt. This particular category is primarily the following one. Mr. Volpe, our respondents tell us, is a multimillionaire contractor. To be a multimillionaire contractor in the state of Massachusetts, one must be corrupt. Of those voters in our study who did not vote, approximately one half said they did not vote because a vote in Massachusetts is meaningless. One voter gave us the very poignant response. This is a voter who voted. She gave us the following response. Well, I might as well vote as not vote. Now, in a study that we conducted approximately a year and a half ago, we found that, this is a study of the Boston mayoralty election, we found that a very large proportion of our respondents indicated that they thought that the city of Boston was run by a small power elite of corrupt and self-interested individuals. This power elite was identified by the citizens of Boston. It consisted, in their minds, of politicians, contractors, bookies, and other persons who do business with the city. Now, in order to test the depth of the feeling that there is widespread corruption in our public life, we asked voters the following question. It has been suggested in Massachusetts that a code of ethics for honesty in government be established. Do you believe that this code is needed or not needed? That's all we ask. Do you believe the code is needed or not needed? About half the people we talked to, after giving us some answer, proceeded to make some kind of a comment. 70% of our respondents said that a code of ethics in Massachusetts was needed, and one half of those said it would do absolutely no good. I would like to read you two quotations from two of our interviews, which I consider to be representative of the opinion of these people. Yes, the code of ethics is needed. Well, certainly, with all the chance and temptations that a man in public life is confronted with, I can say that I think a code of ethics is needed. But a code isn't something that you sign. It's something that you live by. That's why they call it a code. I think if they asked all the thieves in prison to sign an oath not to steal, they'll have no trouble getting signatures. I don't mean that all the politicians are thieves. I just don't see how they're going to make this thing work. Yes, it's needed. You can't do it. I don't think it can be done. You can't call them crooks. You don't catch them. When a politician gets through, he gets a job handing out favors. You get the runaround, though if you don't know the politicians, you can go to the State House and plead for all you're worth. What you need is to know the guy and have money. Now, we also asked people whether they agreed or disagreed with the following question. The way people vote is the main thing that decides how things are run in this state. This is a standard political behavior question designed to test whether or not people have a sense of political efficacy. That is, whether or not they feel that they have some political power. The way people vote is the main, in this state, is the main thing that decides how things are run. 54% of the people we interviewed disagreed with this. In other words, they believe that voting is not the main thing that determines how things are run in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. With respect to the national samples that have been taken, where this question has been asked, in Massachusetts, the sense of political inefficacy, absence of power, is probably about 25% greater than the country at large. All right, what are the significance of these findings? Well, we have here a very large number of alienated voters. That is, voters who feel politically powerless. These are voters who have learned something about democratic theory in the grammar school. For example, the grammar school tells them that their vote is important. They have come to the conclusion that the vote is meaningless. The grammar school tells them that there's majority rule. They have come to the conclusion that there is minority rule. Consequently, what you have here is something similar to the poignant remark of a voter in a national sample who said, "America looks great on paper." That is what these people feel about democracy, in a sense. They feel that democracy is great on paper, but in Boston it is non-existent. Our findings fall into line with this general view. These are voters who feel powerless, who feel that elections are meaningless, that it doesn't make any difference which candidate is elected. Now, our voters make two assumptions concerning the candidates, our alienated voters. One is that they are corrupt, and the other is that they are lying. Now, if you are a citizen who believes that the candidate is lying, There is absolutely no reason for you to listen to his platform or his program on the assumption that what he is telling you he does not mean sincerely. If you vote in terms of the platform or the program of the candidate, you are behaving irrationally. What our alienated voters are interested in is making some calculation with respect to the honesty of the candidate. How do you make a calculation concerning the honesty of the, or the character of the candidate? Well, you make some subjective, intuitive judgment concerning his character. For example, in a previous study, a voter told us the following. I looked in his eyes, and I knew he was a crook. Now, one candidate that I have recently interviewed told me, said, Professor Levin, the platforms and the programs don't mean anything to the voters in Massachusetts. Quote, what counts is the way your hair is combed. Now, I'd like to make a point. It's the following. Fine. I would like to make a few more points. If you're running for public office in Massachusetts, and voters are looking in your eyes to determine whether you are honest or not honest, it's all well and good for the candidate to know that this is going on, but the subtle problem for the candidate is the following. Should his eyes be green or blue? Because to some people, green eyes denote honesty, and to some people, blue eyes denote honesty. It's all well and good for this candidate to tell me that what counts is the way your hair is combed, but should he part it on the right or should he part it on the left? Massachusetts politics has been reduced to a large extent to considerations of this kind. This is to a very large extent what political strategists in Massachusetts are concerned with, and it's an extremely delicate and extremely subtle problem. All right, now, I would like to say the following. In Massachusetts, it seems to me that corruption is not the real issue. Corruption in local politics is widespread in the United States, perhaps even universal. The issue is the incompetence of the legislature. That is the issue, the incompetence of the politicians, not their corruptibility. Now, what has happened in Massachusetts is that over a long period of time, there has developed within the Democratic Party a political class, a political elite, the same group of people running for public office over and over again, gradually consolidating their power. I have in mind Mr. Callahan, for example. Now, this political class has formed in Massachusetts primarily because the citizens are too lazy or too indifferent to do anything about it. The most interesting thing concerning the perpetuation of this class is it just keeps going by the law of inertia, because you people don't try to stop it. Now, let me suggest one final point. Recently, there has been formed in the state of Massachusetts an organization known as COD, C-O-D, the Committee of Democrats. Committee of Democrats is vaguely analogous to the reform groups Mrs. Roosevelt was talking about before. It's a group of young, obviously honest, persons interested in Massachusetts politics. It is trying, essentially, to capture the machinery of the Democratic Party at the state and local level, so that someday it will ultimately have perhaps a significant share of the delegates to the state convention. The interesting thing about the Democratic Party on the state and local level in Massachusetts is the following. It just continues to exist because nobody opposes it. In the town of Brookline, for example, a group of young people with a minimum amount of money and a minimum amount of organization unseated the local Democratic Town Committee. And we have two things, in a sense, there are two things, I think, working in favor of reform in Massachusetts. One is the massive alienation of the voters, and two is the apathy of the Democratic Party, which will make it possible for reformers, for reform groups, to move in quite easily, I think, and take over the machinery of the party.
Thank you, Dr. Levin. We have now come to the question part of the program. And as I indicated, those who wish to ask questions should come forward to this microphone in the the center of the room. In asking your question, would you please say to whom it is directed, and would you please remember that you are asking a question and not making a speech? Where is our first questioner? Here we come.
I direct my question to all three panelists.
No, I think you'd better designate one and others can follow. They can't all talk at once. We haven't any facilities for trios.
I am a citizen of Massachusetts, and I read as a newspaper the New York Times. I don't think that this is a strange thing for me to do, because I find that in Massachusetts, none of the newspapers seem to give me all the news I want to read or find out about. I would like you to tell me in order, one after the other, which is the best newspaper to read in Massachusetts if you want to find out something about Boston and Massachusetts politics day after day and be able to form a fairly intelligent opinion about Massachusetts politics.
Well, who wants to start with that? Dr. Levin?
There's one Boston political reporter who I think is very, very competent and who writes well, and that's David Farrell of the Boston Herald. The fact that he is constantly attacked by Senator Piles is probably the surest sign that he is one of the most subtle reporters.
Mr. McDonough, you want to reply to that one?
There are four or five papers. Pick out one and get slammed around by four, which isn't bad. I don't know whether I should say it or not, but I find that I buy the Monitor, and I rather enjoy following the state and the local picture in that, although I must agree with Professor Hedge my bet just a little bit by saying that Dave Farrell's very good, too, and please stay away from me, Dave.
Dr. Wood?
I guess I've got to stand up for the Globe and really say that, by and large, you don't get the New York Times on the same kind of quality, of course, here. Primarily, I guess, because we decided, given the quality of Massachusetts politics, you'd get too much for a nickel.
Where do you get it for a nickel now?
Darn, okay.
Dr. Levin?
Dean Griswold. I assume many of you have noticed that Senator Powers is going around the state right now, and he is saying that all of this political alienation is due to the fact that the New Boston newspapers are fanning all of this cynicism and unjustly pointing out how evil the state legislature is. Now, undoubtedly, the newspapers are very important in the formation of political opinion in Massachusetts, but I'd like to point out one thing. When I was interviewing the candidates and the campaign managers and the fundraisers before September, about 70 or 80% of them told me that they had to pay political reporters in the Boston press for every piece of information they got into the paper. Consequently, if the papers are corrupt, evidently the people who are running for public office are too.
Mrs. Roosevelt. Mrs. Roosevelt raised the question of our two-party system and our tradition of two-party politics in world affairs today and in the Cold War. It seems to me that this is the issue in the Cold War rather than the false issue of East versus West, because the East has about six times as many people as we do. Would you agree, Mrs. Roosevelt, that if the government of the United States can't win the Cold War, that maybe the Democrats and the Republicans, both in this country but also around the world, not as Americans who are ugly, but as Democrats and as Republicans with a two-party system against the one-party principle of the Soviets, could be brought to the people of the world so they would see that maybe two-party systems are the wave of the future and the one-party principle is an obsolete principle?
The question, Mrs. Roosevelt, I think if I can summarize it, is Do you hear me?
Yes, I do.
The question is whether we do not have something in the United States in the two-party system, which, whether we are Republicans or Democrats, can be shown to around the world to have advantages over the one-party system, in that it does bring in the participation of the people in the governmental process, despite all these problems of corruption and everything else which have been referred to as involved in our present system.
Well, I think all of us who believe in our form of government think that the two-party system is essential to getting decisions. But, and we would probably say that the one-party system is of absolutely no value. But you must remember that in large areas of the world, and I don't think they are particularly interested in questions such as whether you have one party or two parties. They primarily are interested in whether they can eat or not. That's the first human right. And therefore, just on that, you're not going to influence the world. It's, large sections of the peoples of the world. It's terribly important to people who are in a position to study ways of government and to understand them. But there are a lot of people who are going to take a long while before they judge simply on the question of whether you have a choice or whether you are told that you, that what's being offered you is so good that there's no point. This is the Russian argument. We have everything so well thought out that we don't have to have a choice, because we know what is best. Now, that to us sounds utterly ridiculous. But there are a good many people in the world who say, well, these questions are questions we don't know much about. But we do know when we're able to eat. And I think we have to realize that man does not live by bread alone, but he must first have bread, and then he can be led to think of the other things. And I have a feeling that I wouldn't base it on the value of the two-party system. I would always base it on what it does for the individual human being.
Are there other members of the panel who'd care to comment on that? All right.
This question is directed to Mrs. Roosevelt, and I hope some of the other panelists might comment. Mrs. Roosevelt, with yourself as a notable exception, and with a few other women active in government, it seems that ever since women have won suffrage, they have done very little in the political scene. I would wonder if you would like to comment as to what you think should be the political role of the First Lady when she's living in the White House, and also of women in politics in general.
Well, women, of course, you know, are human beings. And if men haven't become the perfect citizen, I don't suppose you could expect women in the short time that they've had to become perfect citizens either. As to a woman's role in the White House, traditionally, a woman's role in the White House is to give her husband as little trouble as possible. to then be as good a hostess as possible. And her job as a hostess is quite taxing. She must stand up and receive many days in the week for a number of hours. She must have certain formal parties. She is restricted in many ways. And life is pretty well set out for you if you live up to the tradition. Now, if you happen to come to the White House in a period where domestic situations in which a woman can do something and are very, very much in evidence, then I think that the temptation for any woman who has a good deal of knowledge as to the situations that are arising to do something outside of the traditional is very great. She will only be able to do anything if she has had a background which helps her to understand what the situations are. If she hasn't, then she will do more harm than good, and it is better for her to live up to the traditional role. But first and foremost, no matter whether she has the temptation and can do outside things or whether she lives according to the traditional, the main thing that a woman has to think about in the White House is not to be in her husband's way.
Where is the next questioner? Yes, Gus, go ahead. Extra charge for this, but we'll take care of that later.
I asked the one about the two-party systems to Mrs. Roosevelt. I'll speak louder this time. Taking the idea that people do have to eat and that the Communist World Party tells people that they have a way of feeding them, and using the idea of politics, you see, instead of letting the Communist World Party tell everybody that they'll feed them, why couldn't the Democrats and the Republicans train people, send them around the world, teaching people how to have two-party systems and also having, not a promise, but food, handouts, you know, pork barrel type of thing?
Well, perhaps that is one of the things that you had better suggest to the Peace Corps. Because that may be one of the useful things that they can do.
Well, here's a questioner.
I wish to carry this a little bit further. My question is directed to Mrs. Roosevelt. I'm afraid tonight I feel a little bit like Dean Griswold in Being a Lamb with the Wolves. In your closing remarks, Mrs. Roosevelt, you referred to our present economic system. In saying, I believe, and if I am wrong, please correct me, that the concept of capitalism is not necessarily needed for success in democracy. Would you please elaborate on this, and I would appreciate it if the other panel members would do the same.
What I said was that it was not impossible to live.
You've been listening to another of the Harvard Law School forums brought to you by WHDH Radio News and Public Affairs. The topic for tonight was unrest in the Democratic Party. Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt was the principal speaker. Your dial's alive on 85.